It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin is set to receive more than $700 million in settlement funds from companies that contributed to the opioid crisis. That calculation is from the State Justice Department. Most of the funds will go to dozens of local governments that were part of the litigation. We discuss ways these funds could be used to prevent and treat opioid use disorder. And we hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Sorum is Executive Vice President and CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
So glad to be joining this morning. Thanks.
Yes. And Lori Vedura is co-founder of Saving Others for Archie. That's an organization named after her son who died from a fentanyl-laced substance in 2014. Lori, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. I'm happy to meet you, Sarah, as well.
Lori, let's start with you. This May, 10 years will have passed since Archie since you lost your son, Archie, how are your efforts to raise awareness of opioid addiction different today than in past years?
Well, I just, first of all, cannot believe that it's going to be 10 years this May. Never in my life did I think that this is the path that I would lead. But unfortunately, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of families who are in the same boat I am. And in 2014, I, you know, had no idea of what, where my world was heading. So you just are never prepared to lose a child. And I don't think it matters in what way that you do lose a child. Archie was a wonderful, full of life, full of joy, human being that just lived every day and was a happy human being. But he, you know, struggled with substance use, really started in high school. So for him, I look and I did everything to try to save him and realized that I couldn't. And I really thought I did. But those 4 years of high school were really not any heart drugs. It was really marijuana, which he called his best ADHD medicine. But for him, it's really what hijacked his brain. So when I look at the day that we lost Archie in May 2014 and where we are today, my efforts are completely different because this wasn't, you know, that year alone in 2014, Wisconsin lost 622 people to this terrible epidemic. And it wasn't, you know, even on the radar for any people. And the stigma was so huge, I can't even tell you what it was like. And here we are now as a nation, it's 300 people a day over that we're losing. And I can't tell you. I mean, my efforts as far as an organization have ramped. We've gone from having one major event a year to this past year, we had five.
Sarah, over the next several years, Wisconsin is set to receive more than $700 million from the settlements of lawsuits with manufacturers. How are the roles of pharmacists different now that opioid use disorder is better understood?
Yeah, Lori, it's really wonderful to have you on and nice to meet you too. I think you're right that there's been a lot of progress made with stigma and stigma among the approaches that healthcare providers take in managing individuals with substance use disorder. And so I think that's been a great evolution. Healthcare providers, including pharmacists, are learning about substance abuse disorder in their training. It's become a focus of the policies and procedures that pharmacies have developed. So I think there's really a recognition among healthcare providers that this is an all hands on deck approach, and pharmacists are the most accessible healthcare providers and certainly play a role in aspects of the harm reduction and treatment of patients with substance use disorder.
Right, because, pharmacists, you could say that they're on the front lines of dispensing opioid pain meds. I mean, what is that front line of defense of engaging the patient on what they're taking?
Yeah, truly, it's a really important that we're educating the public about the seriousness of these medications, and there's definitely a place in therapy for opioids, and there's also drug interactions and issues that people can encounter. Diversion of opioids is typically the place where many individuals first have their exposure to opioids in their substance use disorder journeys. And so, education, I think, is the first step. There's also other mitigation strategies that communities are using that pharmacists are involved in, like disposal or take back programs, naloxone distribution. And so I think it's, a very multi-pronged approach that we can, pharmacists from our lens can play a role in.
We're talking about the opioid crisis with Sarah Sorum there of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, Lori Badura of Saving Others for Archie. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Lori, your organization, as you said, is putting on these events after event, raising money, and then turning around and distributing that to other groups running opioid treatment and recovery programs in Wisconsin. Where do you see the greatest need for the opioid settlement funds coming into the state?
Thank you for bringing that up, because I have never in, I would say in the last 10 years, seen such a just a rise. My phone constantly rings with families and individuals, asking for help and what can they do. I have a resource guide that is statewide. I partner with an organization called With Hope, and we made this booklet that's a mental health and substance use for Wisconsin resource guide. We'll make sure to give you a link so you can
Thanks.
have it. But more than anything, there's a big bottleneck. I'm so happy because I agree exactly with what Sarah has said. The stigma, there's so much work that has been done and so many people that have really done countless times and efforts. I'm sure, Sarah, you probably sit on several different, task forces, and that aren't paid that you're doing in your time that I've been doing for my last 10 years that I'm on, but in prevention, harm reduction, treatment and recovery, and trying to see what the unmet needs are. But within my organization in these past 6 months, what I'm seeing the bottleneck is really in the funding and trying to get the funding to come in to the patient when they are coming to try to get their overall funds to get the treatment. And the problem is they can get Medicaid, but for some reason there's a bottleneck. They get through their treatment with the Medicaid, and then when they get through it, they can't get to, say, a long-term, like a sober living or a long-term living place where, if they just go home, they're going to relapse. And that's not a good thing. I believe in, really a long-term solution so that we can get them back into working, back into getting, a good a situation that's safe and they can work their treatment program still by working. That they need a funds for that. And that typically goes from anywhere from $700 to $1,400 a month. They don't have it, but there is funds out there. So SOFA has, I would say about two a month for the past 6 months, individuals that I've sponsored, and I'm a small organization, but I get multiple requests. in for these scholarships that my board will, you know, either and I have letters that they say what they're going to do, what the accountability is going to be, what kind of job they're seeking, and it's all statewide. And even I
So
help people out of state.
there's rehabilitation and there's that process, that journey, but there's also aftercare, the continuing support, you know, that needs to be the follow-up and along this continuum of recovery, that aftercare process is not being adequately funded.
Well, it's yes, because it
Okay.
needs to go forward, but also Medicaid currently does not cover room and board, and what they do cover for residential treatment for substance use disorder, it really does not adequate to actually pay the bills. They're having to the consumers, the individuals having to, you know, give more of their money, and they really don't have it. I mean, they're not working, so they're having to, you know, ask family members and friends to help them. And if it's a 30-day or if it's an intensive outpatient treatment, they're having to come up with funds to help with that, you know, their room and board, even on, you know, their residential treatment. The same is said for outpatient. They do not pay adequately to be able to support a clinic, to be able to provide services for people with substance use disorder that have Medicaid. So I just see that there's a little bit of a bottleneck. I'm not sure how the state, because I know the money's there. It just needs to go a little bit smoother because sadly, people are really trying to, you know, get help. And it's a very, very stressful situation. I see it. They're scared and they don't want to slip backwards. And time is, you know, it's clicking. The clock is ticking.
Lori Bedura is co-founder of Saving Others for Archie to raise awareness about the dangers of opioids and to prevent more deaths. And pharmacist Sarah Sorum, CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, is here. Call in with a question, share perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Opioid manufacturers and distributors will pay tens of billions of dollars to settle lawsuits over the toll of opioids. And our state justice department estimates Wisconsin's share tops $700 million. We get perspectives on how those funds can be used to prevent and treat opioid use disorder. Lori Bedura co-founded the advocacy group Saving Others for Archie, and Sarah Sorum is CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Sarah, your organization created a toolkit to help guide pharmacists and the government allocating the settlement money. What tools are in this toolkit that can help reduce opioid abuse?
There's so many great efforts that are happening truly at the grassroots level in communities across the state. And we know that pharmacists are just one part of that picture for how to address this epidemic in an all hands on deck approach. So the toolkit that we created is designed to empower pharmacists to connect with their local officials, county governments, to say, here's how I can help. And it includes focuses on harm reduction, stigma, naloxone distribution, medication disposal, syringe service programs, a number of other tools that are in the toolbox for how the pharmacist can be part of the team-based care approach to address the epidemic. And also, too, from a treatment standpoint, Lori did a great job of talking about the issues around long-term recovery. We know that medications are often an important role in treatment and long-term recovery. And so pharmacists can also play a role in long-acting injectable administration in the pharmacy to be accessible and really keep patients out of challenging situations.
How has the toolkit been received?
We have been so pleased with the reception around the toolkit. I mean, I think we're just at, there's been really great conversations that have happened in communities, but community plans are still underway. And so I think it's the perfect time for us to be raising awareness about this resource. I've also had the opportunity to share our toolkit beyond Wisconsin because other states are dealing with this same issue. And it is just amazing the outpouring of response from healthcare providers across the country to say, we want to help. We need the tools to be able to help. And this infusion of resources in communities is going to help accelerate our efforts.
Let's bring on a call now at 800-642-1234. Martha in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hi, good morning. I don't know Archie's story, and I tuned in right away, but my question is, I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, that in states that have medical marijuana or marijuana laws, the opioid abuse rates are way down compared to states that don't. And Archie's mother mentioned that he did use marijuana to help with his issues. I don't know the backstory, but could Archie not get the marijuana he was using that caused the opioids to become so,
Yeah.
important, as such a thing? I'm just wondering what the guests feel about the role of marijuana and if it could have helped.
Martha, thank you. Lori, go ahead.
Thank you so much for your question. Back in 2014, it was again, it was, I had no idea. This was a kid that was very honest, came from, came home from football practice and said, this is something I learned, Mom. It's called Mary Jane. I mean, he was extremely honest. So it was, for him, it wasn't a dabbling to help him. I guess I didn't look at it like that because it was a very quick fall in his character. All of a sudden, his grades were slipping. All of a sudden, he wasn't showing up for practice. And all of a sudden, things were missing out of our house so he could pay for, this new, thing that he loved. And that's what we were trying to help him with. And he realized that it was really in for him. So that's why everybody's different. And I think for medical marijuana, I think it's great. And I have, it's just different. I can only speak about my son. I'm not a, a medical professional, but I know the data. And I do believe that for my son, it was an opener because that was the first thing. He looked for that next thing after that to get somewhere higher in his brain because I believe it's just trying to feel better. No one's trying to die or hurt themselves at all. That's not what this is. This is about people seeking, their, it's really mental health is what I believe that this whole thing is. And so I know each state is different, but I can't really speak to, I just feel like for my son, his brain was hijacked and I really never got him back. And my surviving son will say the same thing. And really, even Archie, after surviving in, on a 3 month treatment program in the wilderness, he said it fogged his brain so much. So for him, it just wasn't a good fit.
A follow-up there. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call says the state's portion of legal settlements is a huge amount of money, but falls short of matching the impact that the epidemic has had. Sarah Sorum, in our few moments we have left together, what do you make of that sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, it is a really big issue, and Lori's right. There's an epidemic of mental health issues, particularly as we come out of the pandemic, an epidemic of loneliness. And it truly needs an all hands on deck approach. So while there is this huge infusion of resources, there will still be wish lists that communities will have, and how do we tackle this problem? And I think that's where we need to get creative. We need to work together, communicate, and truly view this as our really big collaborative effort to bring our state out of this epidemic.
Sarah Sorum, Executive Vice President, CEO of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. Lori Bedura, founder of Saving Others for Archie, on the morning show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Milwaukee County ends a program that collects money from fathers to cover the costs of childbirth under government-funded health care. And the program applied only to fathers who were unmarried and had no custody rights to their children. As this birth cost recovery program sunsets, we examine the future of this form of government collections across Wisconsin, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Bryn McBride is Chief Operating Officer and Public Interest Attorney at ABC for Health. That's a Madison-based nonprofit public interest law firm advocating for health equity and social justice in healthcare. Bryn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, let's get some working knowledge of this. Can you explain what your organization calls the birth tax?
Yeah, thanks. It's a complicated policy. It's one of those that most people probably haven't heard of. We call it one of those Medicaid policies that's a little deep in the weeds, the policy weeds, but it actually has quite a disparate impact. So just to break it down, it's a medical collections process. And a lot of folks probably think as medical collections usually stemming from hospitals, but this is one instance where a collection action actually starts from the county. It all happens when a pregnant woman is enrolled in Medicaid and is not married. The collection action is, like you described, it's an action against the father. We started learning about it many, many years ago because of the impact it had on the pregnant woman, on the mother. She's the one that immediately has to face a decision upon becoming pregnant and being enrolled in Medicaid. If she's going to identify the father and therefore start the collection action against him, or refuse to cooperate and therefore be subject to a sanction. And the sanction is she gets her Medicaid taken away 60 days postpartum.
That could interfere with care, though. That could interfere with, prenatal care for if the mother fears applying for Medicaid, and revealing the father.
Absolutely. And that's really how we first started hearing about the policy. It's not something we were reading on the books, just academically. We would get a call from a social worker or a public health nurse or a home visiting nurse saying, I met this woman. She was at the emergency room to deliver, having had no prenatal care. What do you think happened? How did we miss her in this system of prenatal care? And we started just hearing anecdotal stories of saying, oh, I didn't want to disclose my boyfriend or my partner or the father's baby, and therefore decided to forego the healthcare coverage and therefore the care that was needed. And you start putting all of the pieces together to figure out what is actually happening in this scenario, how many people this is actually impacting, how many people are pregnant and enrolled in Medicaid, and you start seeing that it's a much bigger problem than we first envisioned.
Bryn, your organization reports Wisconsin leads the nation in birth cost recovery efforts. What does that mean? What does Wisconsin gain from leading the nation in this area?
Nothing. There's no winning here with this policy. It's one that's extremely inequitable, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But it's a policy that is discretionary. We had a chance to talk with the Federal Child Support Office, and we'll talk about child support's role in this in just a bit too. And they said it's discretionary to states, and most states have said we're not going to do it. States like Minnesota, some of the other states around Wisconsin said this is not in the best interest of children to put this mother in this catch-22 at the moment she's pregnant and seeking health care. That ends up having bad maternal health outcomes. It has bad infant mortality and infant health outcomes because of the risk of jeopardizing prenatal care and a good start to this baby's life. And then you have other states like Idaho, which actually had a Supreme Court case over this saying on equal protection grounds, it treats men and women differently, and therefore they ditched the policy. Wisconsin has held firm to this policy. It's one of about 6 to 8 states that still pursues it. The collections actions, Wisconsin is the most aggressive, and Milwaukee is the most aggressive of all the counties. You know, there's been some effort to try to get rid of it. Governor Evers in his first budget said, let's get rid of birth cost recovery. And then the legislature tossed that out of the budget. So there has been an effort statewide to toss this discriminatory policy, but it's still on the books. And some counties have said, we're not going to do this. We're going to take that discretion and we're not going to pursue these collection actions. But other counties have been quite aggressive.
And so from what I understand, Dane and Milwaukee County have recently discontinued the practice, although, as you mentioned, other counties are continuing. Considering these are the two most populous counties in the state, what implications will that change have?
It's big. It's big news. You know, across the state of Wisconsin, Wisconsin counties hold about $106 million of these judgments for which they're pursuing. That's about 80,000 judgments. About 80% of those are held in Milwaukee, Dane, Racine, and Kenosha counties. Even though, you know, those only make up 31% of the population of the state, that's where 80% of these judgments are held. So getting rid of Dane and Milwaukee counties is going to take care of the brunt. I mean, Milwaukee itself holds most of those collection actions. I think Milwaukee has about 52,000 judgments, about $70 million. Dane County is under right around 4,000 judgments, $6.5 million. So that's the scale of what we're talking about for these judgments. But it's still going to be a process. These judgments aren't gone. This went through a budget process to say, let's, as a county, let's eliminate this discriminatory practice. It kind of had a rocky start in Dane County, and it's been up for debate before in Milwaukee County. But finally, both county boards' supervisors in the latest round of budget negotiations did strike the policy. So it still has to be implemented. It still has to be rolled out. We still have to see how it's actually going to play out to cancel these orders, these judgments, because these are court orders that have to be canceled. And then, you know, from there, make sure that other counties start taking action.
Talking about a birth cost collection system for low-income families, Bryn McBride is a leader at ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit public interest law firm. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Bryn, you mentioned some rocky situations in Dane County as it makes a switch. In 2020, the county said it would discontinue pursuing new birth cost recovery collections. What happened after that policy switch?
Oh, it's so curious. It was, again, through the budget process at the end of 2019, County Executive Joe Parisi's budget. He announced effective January 1st, 2020, we are eliminating the discriminatory practice of birth cost recovery. That was the statement. And so what they actually started doing January 1st, 2020, was to stop collecting new judgments from January 1st moving forward. But all of those old judgments that happened before 2020 were still on the books, and they still aggressively pursued collection on those. So it felt a little disingenuous of saying it's a discriminatory policy moving forward, but we're still going to collect on the discriminatory policy that was moving backwards in time. What happened in 2020, again, the first year of the COVID pandemic, mind you, we saw that Dane County actually collected almost twice as much as they had in 2019. And part of the reason for that was aggressive collections actions, but also they were intercepting stimulus checks, unemployment bonuses. Some of the COVID relief coming into low-income families was being grabbed to satisfy government debts. So that's what caught our when we did a several data requests from the state, from the county, to try to piece together what's happening. And we just assumed in 2020 we would see collections actions dramatically drop. And we were just floored when we saw that it doubled. So Congress then, that was the first stimulus check that Congress issued in early 2020. When they issued their second round of stimulus checks, they actually wrote language that said that you can't intercept these funds, that they are intended to go to low-income families. So it was just the first round of stimulus checks that the county intercepted. But that, painting that picture together, we did the data request, we saw the dramatic increase in collections. We started a conversation again with Dane County saying, let's fix this once and for all. Let's get rid of these old collection actions that you're still pursuing. We didn't hear a lot from the county executive office, but we did find some support on the county board of supervisors that had both an equity initiative that they're pursuing, but also had an attention on getting rid of unnecessary fines and fees against low-income families in our community. And I think this struck a chord with them to say this is both discriminatory from an equity perspective, but also it is just one more example of a county charging a fee on a low-income family that needs to be investigated. So that was the Dane County scenario.
Do any of these funds that are collected by the counties through this process, do any of the funds, from the identified father go back to the family in some way to support it?
No, not at all. And that's such an important point, Kate. It's this is a state process. State agencies are the ones establishing the collection process. It's carried out by counties through their child support office, but it is absolutely not child support. It's carried out by the child support office because they have a mechanism for collection already established. So they're the ones charged with doing these collections actions. Not one penny that is collected from a father goes to support the mother or the child. So it is absolutely not child support. The money actually goes back to refund the state and federal Medicaid program. The county gets to keep an incentive, 15% of what they collect. We call that the county bounty. They're the collector, they keep a percentage, they have an incentive to collect, but it really goes out of that household and it diminishes the available funds in that household to actually support the family.
Bryn McBride with us, public interest attorney at ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit healthcare advocacy organization in Madison as we explore the impact of birth cost recovery programs in Wisconsin communities. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The two most populous counties in Wisconsin moved to dismantle or limit their birth cost recovery system. We discuss the effects of forcing unwed fathers to pay back the Medicaid program for part of the childbirth costs. And you can add your thoughts to the conversation, or you can ask a question by calling 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Bryn McBride with us, a public interest attorney at ABC for Health. Bryn, some Wisconsin counties like Racine and Kenosha continue collecting payments from unwed fathers when the mother is on Medicaid. How much discretion do counties have in pursuing these collections, these payments?
They have full discretion. It really is one of those policies. The edict comes down from the feds, it goes through the state. That says this is there aren't a lot of statutes that say you have to collect this money. It is discretionary. Some other counties, not as populous across Wisconsin, have said we're just not going to do this. There's no advantage to it. There was one corporation counsel in a northern Wisconsin county that said, I see no advantage for families, especially for children, of pursuing these. The reason some county have given for doing the collection action is purely revenue. They have said, we don't want to lose this money source. This is an easy revenue source in our county. It's a different day, though. We're in 2024 now. The shared revenue makes a different situation for some of these counties. There are new personnel. There are new county initiatives on equity. And I think there's more data as well. We know what some of the racial impacts and disparities look like in some of our Wisconsin counties, especially Racine and Kenosha. You know, this is, we've talked about this as an equity issue. Then let's just kind of break down what that looks like for Medicaid births. About half of the births in the state of Wisconsin are covered by Medicaid. Of these, about 66% are to unmarried families. Black families are subject to this policy more than white families. The number looks like 88% of Medicaid deliveries to Black women are to unmarried women. The next highest racial statistic is 85% of Medicaid deliveries to Indigenous women is to unmarried women. And that's compared to 58% for white. So there is a Black, white, non-white, white issue here. When you start looking at some of the demographics of Racine and Kenosha County, you can see how this is a policy that's impacting Black families more than white families. You know, the March of Dimes gave Milwaukee an F for its poor health outcomes in their last report card. And they also named Wisconsin as one of the states with the highest racial and ethnic disparities in preterm birth. So there is a lot of work to be done in Wisconsin. And we're not suggesting that getting rid of this one discretionary policy is going to fix all of that. But it certainly is a really easy win.
Bryn, we're hearing from Jeff in Delafield, called in to ask that it's interesting that the recovery money goes to the state, but they're concerned about taking a mechanism away that discourages poor decision making. And Jeff is concerned about this program adding to the burden on taxpayers. What are your insights on those feelings?
You know, for us, the reality, and it's something we've heard before, the reality is the pregnancy is here. The woman is already pregnant. And now we have to decide as a state, what is our priority going to be? Are we going to support the unborn child and the pregnant person through pregnancy? Or are we going to punish the pregnant person, saying, shame on you, you made a bad decision, therefore, no Medicaid for you. As soon as you deliver. We've heard of people caught up in this policy. First of all, it's one that creates an extreme amount of stress in a home when a pregnancy is identified and all of a sudden you have a conflict between the mother and the father saying, we have this collection action against us now, and you're stressing a pregnant woman. And we know the impacts of toxic stress on pregnant women. And of course, the stuff we already talked about deterring prenatal care. But we also see people that are culturally married but not legally married getting caught up in the policy. We see a father who is maybe out of the home because of work, who the state is considering to be an absent parent just because of circumstance, who was caught up in the policy. We've also met some young couples that were going to grad school. They were pursuing professional degrees. Their doctor worked with the family and upon medical advice said it might be to your advantage to start your family early because of the medical condition that the mother had that was degenerative. And they said, you know, we followed our doctor's advice and said, if we're going to start a family, let's do it now. Let's not wait. But then they got caught up in a collection action because of that decision. So like I said, the reality is the pregnant person is already pregnant. What we have also started to learn is some of the consequences of child support cooperation because of this policy. So you want to talk about personal responsibility. Let's put our efforts towards collecting child support to actually support the parent and the child. There's new research that is suggesting, and it's early, but it is suggesting that when you eliminate birth tax collection, you actually see better compliance with child support.
I want to ask you, though, what are the consequences for fathers who don't make these collection payments?
Just like disobeying any other court order or judgment. So failure to pay, they'll try to collect from the father. There might be a wage intercept.
But they garnish wages.
They certainly do garnish wages. They certainly intercept tax returns. Like we saw in Dane County, if there's any other funds coming in from the feds, they'll try to intercept that as well. So it really does take the money out of the home.
Bryn McBride with us, leader at ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit public interest law firm as we talk about a birth cost collection system. You can join in questions and comments 800-642-1234. We're in looking outside of Wisconsin. New laws in Louisiana and Utah require fathers to pay for at least half of their child's birth costs. Would you support requiring payments from fathers and sending the money to the birthing parent?
Oh, what an interesting question. It still triggers back to the decision that has to be made by the pregnant person. The moment upon becoming pregnant and being enrolled in Medicaid, it's the difficult choice and the difficult consideration that the pregnant person has to make. Do I identify the father or suffer a consequence? And I think that decision would still exist no matter where the money goes. So it's, I think what works best and what the new research is suggesting is let child support play the role of being that mechanism of one parent supporting the custodial needs of the other and taking care of the child. Get rid of the extraneous medical collections process that actually seems to deter any kind of support from one parent to the other.
How do counties decide how much a male father must pay?
It's prescribed by a state agency. There are a couple different methods for calculating the judgment, and some counties do it differently. It's either a percentage of the father's monthly income that is required, a percentage of a regional average, or a percentage of the actual cost of the birth. That calculation has actually improved over time. It used to be just a really ridiculous number. There also used to be a policy, if you go several decades back, where if they couldn't determine the father's income, they would impute income to the father. They would say, well, we don't know the exact amount of money you have, so we're going to just suggest that you probably have X amount of money, to $40,000 a year. And then they would base the recovery action off of that. That just was another whole debacle. In many instances, we were meeting women that said, I'm picking up a second job because I'm trying to pay the collection action because there's such a ridiculous judgment against my boyfriend.
We only have a few seconds left, but what are the next stages here, next steps that ABC for Health is working on this issue?
The first one is just a broader education. As these counties, Dane and Milwaukee, like we've talked about, are ending the policy, first, we're going to be a watchdog on that. They say they're ending in 2024. We have yet to see the implementation steps. We want to make sure this isn't slow walked and taking several years. This needs to move quickly. For the main reason is the first round of intercepts happens at tax time. Mm-hmm. So, there's going to be another 2024 round of government intercepts here. Sanctions are coming back after being paused during COVID. So we have women that could be facing the punishment sooner rather than later. So watching Dane and Milwaukee County make sure they implement it. Doing education to families to make sure they know that this is a fine or a fee that's being absolved and not their child support.
Bryn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bryn McBride is Chief Operating Officer and Public Interest Attorney at ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit public interest law firm advocating for health equity and social justice in the healthcare financing system. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In Greene County, snow and ice-covered roads are getting a taste of cheese this winter. The county hopes cheese brine, that's a waste product from cheese manufacturing, can be an environmentally friendly and cost-effective way to reduce using rock salt. WPR producer Courtney Everett recently talked with the county's highway commissioner, Chris Narveson.
Chris, the Greene County Highway Department is partnering with a nearby cheese factory to improve winter road conditions. The county is spreading cheese brine to then help melt ice on the roadways. How does cheese brine melt ice?
When we put down rock salt, we put it down on the center lane and we make a brine in the center. So the first time through, they'll plow all the snow off and we apply on the second round coming back through. Rock salt, the way it works is it has to create a brine. So when you apply brine directly, it's already working for you. The other advantage of having of using brine for the road is pre-brine before a storm. Up to 2 days before it, we can go out and we know a storm is going to come. And it also helps with other things like frost. You know, people, you know, you don't think about it when you're driving, but, you know, when your windshield frosts up, well, so do the bridges, you know, so do your shaded areas. So we'll go out and we'll pre-brine, especially those areas. That also buys you time when a storm comes. It can accumulate a little bit. And what it does, it makes a little bit of a snot layer between the road and the snow. So when a tire cuts through it, it actually cuts right back down to the road. Otherwise, if you don't have that layer between there, you'll get hard pack on your road.
So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says the most common type of salt used on roads is sodium chloride, or basically the same salt on dinner tables. You mentioned salt in this cheese brine. So is it without salt, or does this cheese brine include some sort of salt as well?
Yes, there is salt in cheese brine. And what I never realized was that all of these cheese factories, the cheese brine that they use is a trade, the salinity in it is a trade secret. So when we get our cheese brine from the cheese factory, they blend it to our specifications. So we want it between 20-22% salt.
Okay. And why is that certain percentage important to this kind of recipe, if you will, or this mixture?
It flows through the trucks at 22% better. It won't freeze. So we don't have to worry about if it gets too low in salinity, then it'll freeze in our tanks.
Explain how the Greene County Highway Department receives the cheese brine and then distributes it on local roads.
Okay, so what we do is we have a tanker truck and we'll park it at the cheese factory. When they're ready for us to take a load, we load up that tanker. It's about 6,000 gallons and we transport that to our holding tank. We've got about 50,000 gallon capacity right now. We're going to add this next summer now that we have more trucks coming online being able to use the brine. You know, last year we went through just shy of 100,000 gallons of brine, and it sounds like a big number, but there's counties out there doing more brine than we are.
What counties are doing brine, such as yours?
I would venture to say almost all the counties now are starting to venture into the brine area. Very few of them are using cheese brine as we are. You have to be located close enough to the cheese factory to be able to get that.
And speaking of that, I know Burnett County and Polk County previously used cheese brine on their roads. The counties then stopped it when their local cheese factory closed. This is according to a recent article from Business Insider. Is that closure trend a concern for you?
Well, I like to consider Greene County the capital of cheese. When I first got here, I kidded people because I get to go to the accidents. And the first couple of tragedies had to do with cheese. You know? So there's a lot of cheese in this county. So it humorous, but yet tragic.
We're talking about the use of cheese brine on Greene County roads this winter. Our guest is County Highway Commissioner Chris Narveson. Chris, we had earlier talked about the trucks receiving the brine, things like that. You said you're adding a few more trucks to the fleet. How did that process come about?
So here's the problem with going to liquids is that you have to have a truck big enough to carry because you're carrying a lot more weight. You know, our fleet has been primarily two axle trucks. We've been pre-wetting our salt for over a decade. So we have tanks set up on there right now, but it doesn't, the ones that on the smaller trucks, they don't apply it directly to the road. They apply it to the salt as it's coming down to get it activated before it hits the ground. And then it helps so it doesn't bounce them off the road also. So you kind of get a soft landing for that salt. So our problem right now is to moving to this is the size of the truck. So, you know, we run about 24 trucks. We replace about two to three trucks a year. So, you know, the time scale to move this over. And the interesting thing is that I got people, well, we can't get to this. We can't do this because, you know, okay, our trucks are too small. Well, okay, well then we can need bigger trucks. Well, guess what? Now our parking facilities are too small. We have an old shop. So we have things that we have to figure out. We have to figure out other warm areas because we park our trucks in a tempered environment. It's the trucks, it's the places to put them. So we're working our way there.
How much does using this cheese brine cost Greene County compared to the cost of using just road salt?
Okay, road salt, we run through about 4,000 tons countywide. Well, a ton of salt is going to cost you to get it here. It's about $100 a ton to get it here and put it. Greene County is the number two least salt user in the southwestern district for the state of Wisconsin. Well, you might look at that and you go, wow, you're really doing really good. But to put that in perspective, the number one least user is almost half the amount per lane mile as what we are, because they're almost entirely brine.
And where is that?
Jefferson County is the leader of brine usage. Not cheese brine, just brine usage in general. So we're looking at, if we can reduce that to half, that's $200,000. The benefits don't end there. The benefits also are the amount of salt that we're putting back into the environment. We all rely on groundwater or surface water for drinking or recreation.
Right. I'm so glad you brought that up. Does this brine break down in a certain way? How does it affect the environment compared to just that road salt?
It has to do with the amount that you're putting on. And I get calls in the office about, oh, you're out brining and you're destroying my vehicle by putting brine down. And I'm thinking to myself, we're putting down something that's roughly 20% salt versus something that is 100% salt.
I have to ask, is there a distinct smell to the cheese brine on roads?
When we pick it up, it is filtered before we get it. We filter it from the tank to our, you know, putting it into our holding tank. It's filtered when they pull it back out of those tanks into the truck. And then it's filtered before it hits the road again. Any solids that happen that might come back through there are by and large removed. So the answer to the question is not really if we're getting it fresh from the factory. But I will say that it might have a little bit of an odor at it, because we'll load up in the summer. So we'll fill all the tanks. Because when we get going and we start putting a lot down, the cheese factories won't be able to keep up with us. So we eventually will have to reach out to other cheese factories here to help in our supply. Right now, we only currently have one factory that supplies us.
Could other Wisconsin counties adopt Greene County's cheese brining practice this winter?
It's going to be a factor of hauling. It's just like anything. The farther you have to go get it, you know, it's not as economical to you as it is if it's closer by. So, but the problem other counties have with it is if you don't have the setup, it's hard to get to use it. So, but the state is really pushing. They're buying high capacity brine makers for counties statewide. I think as you look into the future, I think the future is going to be more brining.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I sure appreciate you having me. Thanks, Courtney.
And that was WPR producer Courtney Everett speaking with Chris Narveson, Highway Commissioner of Greene County, about using cheese brine to reduce salt on roads in winter. And just ahead, Wisconsin snowmobilers are exploring some freshly groomed trails. We check in with a recreation warden about trail conditions and safety. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to more than 200,000 registered snowmobiles and thousands of miles of groomed trails each winter. That's from the State Department of Natural Resources, here to discuss trail conditions and safety. And you can join this conversation about snowmobiling. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jacob Holzklaw is the DNR's Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator, overseeing the snowmobile and ATV programs across the state. Jake, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Yes. Happy winter to you.
Yeah, it's been a strange winter. We'll just say that.
Okay. Well, the winter storm brought more than a foot of snow to several parts of the state. How are trail conditions out there?
Yeah, so down in the southern part of the state, especially, it's kind of crazy. It seems like the state did a flip-flop. So the first trails to open up in this season were down in the southern part of the state. Reports are that they have some really good snow conditions in some areas. And then you go all the way to the northern counties of the state, and we have trails that have not opened yet. So kind of the full gamut.
Northwoods are kind of like, what's going on here? This is not how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I think exactly. And, you know, you kind of feel for the business owners and the folks up there that do depend on the snowmobilers to bring a lot of funding and tourism up in that area. So we'll just kind of have to see how the winter cooperates.
Well, there are dozens of snowmobile clubs in our state. How do you collaborate with clubs to ensure trails are being properly maintained and properly groomed and marked?
Yeah, so really at the club level, the clubs will work with their local municipalities. They'll work with their local counties and their county forestry and parks departments. There is grant funding available through the state, and that's actually a separate wing that I don't supervise, but they provide grant funding to those counties, and that filters down to the club level. And I would say that, you know, the clubs are composed of some really passionate, dedicated volunteers, and those folks are going to be out there, you know, trying to maintain and make sure that everything is signed really well. We do have when we talk about signage, we do have a trail signage manual or handbook that we do provide from the DNR, and that allows clubs to, you know, be sure that they're signing properly and making sure people have enough heads up when they're getting up to stop signs and things like that.
Well, in 2022, the top snowmobile citation in Wisconsin was failure to comply with regulatory signs. When you talk about that signage, why might this be a common violation?
Well, I think part of it is sometimes when folks get out on the trail, I mean, they're having fun. They're recreating. They're not maybe necessarily thinking about the legalities sometimes. And I think something folks really need to remember is that, yes, snowmobiling is a blast. It can be a lot of fun. It's a very traditional Wisconsin pastime. But the signs there are, especially stop signs or regulatory signs, they're there for a reason. They're there for safety. And, you know, those signs will be placed at intersections, road crossings, things like that. And for good reason, we don't want folks going across the road or getting hit by another vehicle or, you know, maybe coming up to an intersection at a trail and getting hit by another sled. So, that was our top citation issued back in 2022. I just looked at the numbers. It was like 179 citations issued for that. So, yeah, that is something that we do watch pretty closely because it's a big safety issue.
What conversations do you have with local snowmobile clubs as far as snowmobilers staying on trails and off private land?
Well, I think it's just kind of on a case-by-case basis. I would like to get a shout-out, and I know we'll touch on it a little bit more later, but the county rec patrols, the sheriff's departments have a number of patrols throughout the state, and between them and the local wardens, there's some pretty good relationships built with the clubs and the county level. And so if there's issues, a lot of times they'll contact their local warden or their local sheriff's department, kind of let them know that maybe this is a problem area. And then that'll be a section of trails that, you know, if we can get out on patrol, we'll try to watch that and work that area and just make sure everybody's staying on the trail where they're supposed to go. So, because really, you know, Wisconsin has, I hear the number thrown around 25,000 miles of snowmobile trails statewide. So pretty incredible network of trails. And a good majority of those trails, quite a few of those, are on private lands, and we really depend on the goodwill of those landowners to have that trail system.
Well, when I think about such a vast trail system going all over Wisconsin, and then thinking about just the number of recreation wardens, you know, a recreation warden might be over like 9 counties. That's a lot of miles to be able to keep on top of. Is that a challenge for the DNR?
Oh, absolutely. It is. It's a challenge. Like you said, the recreation wardens have a very broad area. They have multiple counties that they're working with, you know, specializing in that rec vehicle enforcement. And then just about every county has 1 to 2, maybe more, field wardens that are also actively involved in that rec enforcement. And then because it is such a vast network of trails, we really do depend on partnerships with other law enforcement.
We're talking about snowmobile patrol and safety with Jake Holzclaw, who is the off-highway vehicle administrator overseeing snowmobile and ATV programs across the state. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So when you have a bunch of different groups, you've got the conservation wardens, the state patrol officers, county sheriffs, municipal peace officers. There's a DNR. Are there gaps in snowmobiling enforcement? What is communication like?
Well, I think for the most part, at least in my area, I live up in the Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls area, and I think there's some really good communication. Obviously, every area is a little bit different, but I think at least in my area, what I've seen is there's some really good communication between the wardens, the state patrol officers, as well as the county sheriff's departments. And a lot of times those agencies will work hand in hand to work together, especially the sheriff's departments and the wardens. You know, you may have a big event or maybe a antique snowmobile ride or an ice race or something held out on the lake, and a lot of times they'll get together and try to meet up for some kind of a safety enhancement detail to improve safety in that area. So yeah, I mean, it varies around the state, but I think for the most part the officers work really well together.
Some people ride these very old snowmobiles. What can you highlight about antique snowmobile registrations?
So antique snowmobiles are kind of a unique animal. They have a unique registration. So if it's over 35 years old, you can get an antique registration for it, and then that'll be a reduced fee. So that is a benefit to it. And like I said, you know, snowmobiling has always been I shouldn't say always, but has long been a passion of folks in Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin or Eagle River area is kind of considered the birthplace of modern snowmobiling. There'll be folks or groups that'll get together and ride a bunch of old sleds, and it can be a lot of fun. It's a good camaraderie and a good time for folks to get together. That antique registration, it's good for 3 years. It's only $20 initially, and then to renew it after that 3 years is $5. So it's a reduced rate over the normal $30 registration for a modern snowmobile.
Turning to tragedies now, the state DNR tracking snowmobile crashes, and between January and October last year, at least 16 fatal snowmobile crashes occurred. More than half of the reported incidents involved people driving under the influence of alcohol.
Yeah.
How is the DNR addressing alcohol use among snowmobilers?
Yeah, that's an unfortunate reality. Obviously, any snowmobile incident is one too many. And so one of the things we do is we have safety messaging statewide, where we get out some messaging at different points throughout the season. We just want to make sure that people realize that, you know, when you're on a snowmobile, or really any wrecked vehicle for that matter, it's no different than driving a car or a truck on the roadway. The same dangers apply, the same legal limits apply as far as alcohol. And just to remind folks too that you can still be under the influence of alcohol even if you haven't, you know, necessarily met the, you know, 08 legal limit in the state. So one of the other things we do too is we try to have our safety enhancement details. We'll have wardens or rec patrols will be out there, you know, maybe later in the afternoon or after dark, monitoring that, watching for different safety violations, and then, you know, stopping people, making sure that they haven't had too much to drink.
I'm just going to pause here. Jake Holzclaw, Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator for the Wisconsin DNR, our guide to the latest on snowmobiling conditions and safety. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your experiences at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore Wisconsin's snowmobile trail system that links all corners of the state. Trails in southernmost Wisconsin have opened before the North Woods, as we've been talking about, and that's from Travel Wisconsin Snowmobile Conditions Map. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jake Holzclaw is the DNR's Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator, overseeing snowmobile and ATV programs statewide. Jake, let's talk about sound. Wisconsin law says the standard noise level for a snowmobile manufactured on or after July 2nd, 1975 should be 82 decibels. So how does the DNR enforce sound standards for snowmobiles?
Yeah, so we have sound testing devices that have been calibrated, and we have a very specific testing sequence where if somebody is suspected of having some very loud sound, and generally wardens and other rec deputies can get a pretty good ear for it. You can kind of tell if that exhaust has been modified, which is another rule. They're not supposed to modify the factory exhaust to make it louder. So we do have some testing devices. We can stop that person and kind of go through that testing process. It only takes a couple minutes, relatively painless. And because that is a big complaint that we do have, especially if they're traveling on private lands, you may have some landowners complaining that, oh, there's some loud sleds. And so that is something we watch for sure.
What does 82 decibels sound like? Can you give any comparison?
That's a good, and it's if you listen to, basically I guess a normal motor noise, mm-hmm. It doesn't sound it just doesn't sound obnoxiously loud, I guess, for lack of a better term. It doesn't have a loud cracking sound to it that's kind of deafning. It is hard to describe without actually sitting by the snowmobile itself.
Yeah, let's not do a demonstration mode there. In terms of operating a snowmobile, over 55 miles an hour during the hours of darkness, saying that's illegal, this limit applies to all public and private areas statewide. Do snowmobilers typically obey nighttime speed limits?
I think most of them do. Yes, I think from what I've seen, most of them do. Where some folks get a little bit, but as we talked about earlier with the fatalities and the injuries, not only is alcohol a factor, but a lot of times speed is a factor, and you combine those two things, and that's a dangerous combination. But every now and then we do have radar units where we can watch sleds out on, maybe an open lake or a big area, a big field where sometimes folks will open up. But one thing we really want to remind folks is that, really any speed over 40 miles an hour after dark, they tend to start overdriving their headlights. So in a way, the headlights can't keep up with the speed that they're going. They just don't have the same power of the headlights that a normal motor vehicle does. And then I did want to touch a little bit on the ice safety, too, for after dark.
Yes. What are conditions in terms of lakes and freezing and snowmobiles going on lakes?
Yeah, it varies so much statewide. It's been such a strange winter. It's been so warm. Last December, even into January, there were some pretty warm temps. Some areas of the state just recently in the last couple days here with this colder snap and snow had some of their lakes freeze over or start to freeze over. So we really caution folks that are getting out on those trail systems. Remember that no ice is ever 100% safe. And, really use some good judgment. Talk to, maybe a local fishing club or a lake organization, something like that. A lot of times they'll keep track of varying ice thicknesses. We don't ever give a safe thickness of ice with the DNR, but obviously you're going to need more ice thickness to support more weight, like a snowmobile or another vehicle on the ice. And then just kind of a shout out too to parents. If you have kids that are near ice or you live near ice, you have access to frozen waterways, really keep an eye on them because it can turn into a pretty tragic situation if we get kids on thin ice. But yeah, and then especially after dark, you know, if somebody's snowmobiling after dark, you talk about overrunning headlights, really hard to see, you know, open areas in the water. You know, there could be ice thick enough to support a sled, and then a few feet away, you have open water because of current or streams underneath. So
dangerous. Yeah.
Could be pretty dangerous. So, you know, use good caution, have a float coat. A lot of snowmobiling gear actually has flotation equipment in it. If you don't have that, you know, maybe take a life jacket with you if you're insistent on traveling on frozen water. Never a bad idea.
Talking about snowmobile patrol and safety with Jake Colesclaw, the DNR's Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jake, what if a snowmobile breaks down? I mean, should you always go in groups, or how do you assist a stranded snowmobiler?
Well, we always encourage folks to travel together. You know, not only is it safer to have two or more folks traveling together, but it's more fun. I think it's just more fun to be out there with, you know, with your buddies or your family. So it's just a good idea. If you do choose to travel by yourself, you know, let somebody know where you're going, approximately when you're going to be back. But it's always a good idea to have some, I guess, for lack of a better term, some survival supplies with you on your snowmobile. You know, have maybe take some hand warmers. They make some really inexpensive, fast-acting chemical hand warmers that you can get nowadays. The other thing, you know, make sure you have a cell phone with you. Keep that protected so it's not going to get wet or frozen. And, you know, sometimes it's not a bad idea to maybe have a snack or some water with you, something like that, in case you're out there for a period of time.
What is your most essential outerwear, you know, on the snowmobile? Like, what do you not leave without?
Well, number one would definitely be just a good snowmobile suit. So a good pair of bibs that are windproof, very warm, good jacket, same thing, windproof, provides a lot of insulation. But I think sometimes what people forget is that when there's going to be a wind chill when you're on a snowmobile, because you're going to be traveling faster. That and any little opening that you have in your gear, the cold's going to find it. So it's always good to have a balaclava or some kind of a, you know, insulation around your neck, around your face, so that you can you don't have any gaps when you put your helmet on around all your gear.
In terms of that helmet, very important piece of gear.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the DNR reports that operators wore helmets in terms of last year's fatal crashes but didn't have a Wisconsin safety certification. Should more snowmobilers take these safety courses?
Oh, absolutely. I would encourage anybody that is ever thinking about snowmobiling, they should take a course legally. Anybody born after January 1st of 1985 needs to take a snowmobile safety course. So, I mean, you're looking at folks now that, you know, up to 39 years old, you need to have that course. You are grandfathered in if you were born before that date, but it's never a bad idea to have that course, because it covers some good specific safety regulations and gets people on the right track. So, yeah, always a good idea. There's in-person courses offered, and then we also offer courses online.
Let's take a call now. Mark in Boulder Junction is here. Mark, hi. Go ahead. What would you like to ask?
Just two questions. One, I'm not sure if the hours have changed for snowmobiling, but why is snowmobiling allowed between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m.? I think you'd solve a lot of problems if you eliminated that time for using snowmobiling. And my other thought is, we always bring up for a lot of different things a number of death accidents happening, but I think a more accurate way is looking at total number of accidents, because of course, I mean, anything can happen as far as, you know, people dying in an accident or surviving. And my wife was an EMT, and she did a lot of calls where people didn't die, but you never hear those statistics at all.
Mark, thank you for bringing up those points. Appreciate it. Jake, go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess the first question, I guess, why can they operate after dark? And I guess it's just one of those things. I mean, it's the folks at our snowmobiling and the state legislature, I don't see that they, I guess, see a problem with it. And admittedly, yes, it can be more dangerous to operate a sled after dark. And there is that temptation to go faster than 55 miles an hour or faster than the trail conditions allow. But, a lot of it does come down to, at some point, the snowmobilers do have to make some good judgment calls on their own. And I think it would restrict people quite a bit if they couldn't operate after dark. You'd have people kind of getting stuck or trapped somewhere, maybe not be able to get back where they're coming from if there was a time frame crunch there. But and as far as injuries, yes, we do keep track of reportable injuries as well. And just for our listeners, just so that they can remember that, if you are involved in a crash that requires medical treatment by a physician, that is a reportable crash. They can complete that. They should notify first off, make sure that anybody else is okay that maybe is involved in the crash, notify law enforcement. But there is actually a self-report form, pretty easy report to complete. And then we do keep track of those. But admittedly, yes, there's probably some crashes that we don't hear about or go unreported. But
do you have concerns about children riding on snowmobiles?
Well, I think it's like any other recreational vehicle. I mean, we want folks to be safe when they have their kids with them. We don't have passenger restrictions or anything like that. So, uh-huh. A child could ride on a sled with an adult. And then also, if a child takes a snowmobile safety course and they're over 12, they can run a snowmobile on a public trail. We always encourage them to be with an adult or a mentor to start out, just to kind of show them the ropes, so to speak, and make sure that they're doing things safely. And you noted before that there really isn't much of an issue with helmets, and that's probably because it's just cold. I think most people choose to wear a helmet out of comfort. Not only is it the safest thing to do, but you could get pretty cold without wearing a helmet. So always encourage folks, and kids, everybody, to wear a helmet when they're on one of these sleds.
Okay, so this is like a favorite child question that I have to ask you before we go. I mean, what do you prefer more, ATVs or snowmobiles?
Oh, man. You asked me the impossible question. When I get out in patrol, I'll tell you, it is a blast getting on a snowmobile. They're very, they can be a lot of fun to run. And most of my experience with a snowmobile is basically working from one in an enforcement capacity, but it can be just as fun on an ATV because, let's face it, the weather's warmer. So I really can't pick a favorite. Sorry.
Oh, well, Jake, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jake Holzklaw is Off-Highway Vehicle Administrator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, overseeing snowmobile and ATV programs statewide. Stay with us for more on snowmobiling and the perspective of Miss Snowflake from the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs. Join the discussion with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We meet Miss Snowflake, who represents the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs at events during a one-year pageant title. Join the discussion along the way. You can call in with a question or add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Brianna Crotto is from Rice Lake and a graduate of UW River Falls and the 2023-2024 Miss Snowflake And as we try to get Brianna here on the line, you can call in with your snowmobile memories and things that you have done to explore in the world of snowmobiling. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. But first, we're going to switch gears here. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tour of a special cave.
Group of people together, even if the fans aren't rooting for the same team. Dr. Arif Ahmed reflects on a cricket tournament in Madison where the pregame jitters were high. It wasn't necessarily because of the game itself, but because of the countries many of the players came from. India and Pakistan. The writer and cardiologist shares a poem about that day.
32 expatriates, Pakistanis and Indians, against a nuclear standoff. March 2019. For Pakistanis and Indians everywhere and in the U.S., in a week of seesaw diplomacy and unsettling war games, I am nervous. An ongoing cricket tournament in Madison, Wisconsin, USA, where Indians and Pakistanis mix up and play. Though I was nervous with more questions than answers, more doubts than convictions. Not for the game, but for the gamesmanship. Would we still come together to play or cancel and stay in our respective bubbles? And just like that, the night came and passed. We did gather and play, all trying and going out of their way to be more gracious, more generous, acutely aware of our global citizenship. This one big mother village, our interdependence, 32 expatriates, Pakistanis and Indians, against the odds, playing cricket over war, choosing team play, and maintaining discourse. Talking with a bat and a ball, we played for peace, yes, peace for all.
Dr. Arif Ahmed of Madison shared that writing about finding harmony through a game of cricket in Madison. After recording his poem, he told me a bit more about his love of cricket.
Well, growing up, this is a sport which has been around the longest. And you know who taught us cricket? The English. When British ruled over subcontinent India and Pakistan, they brought cricket with, and that's how they taught us cricket.
What do you love about the sport?
It's a good sport. It's a fair sport. It gives you a good balance. It's an English version of baseball, and I just like it. I never thought about why I loved it. Yeah, this is the first time I'm thinking about why do I love cricket. Well, I just like it.
So can you talk about the day of this cricket tournament and why it inspired you to write this poem?
So this was a time of a tense standoff between India and Pakistan, who are both neighbors and both are nuclear armed. And we were playing this tournament here, and it was a tense time. It was all over the international news because these two nuclear armed nations are at each other's throat and not backing off. So that's when this piece came about. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that religion, race, region, how can we fight over these things which we don't choose but are born into? And another important concept which I bring out is peace for all. You know, it's a very basic, just like a good air, good quality air, good quality water. Peace for all is a very basic human need.
Dr. Arif Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And if you have an idea for what the morning show should cover next, please get in touch with us. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And if you missed part of our conversation, any day you can stream or download a recording later today at WPR.org/mornings. And there you can check out our program page, find more conversations that we cover from all over Wisconsin, the state, the nation, and even sometimes the world. We always want to hear your ideas, though, for future programs. Go to our program page to leave suggestions via a web form. Two easy steps. The page is WPR.org/mornings. And thank you so much. Did you know also the morning show, as we are live radio, you can always be part of the conversation on the morning show. You can save our call-in number, make it easier. It's 800-642-1234. That number again is 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. And if you want to connect with the morning show on social media, you can find us on Facebook at the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to the morning show here on the Ideas Network.